Martin, Real 9. Now, we've just got to the point where you just reversed out of possible Nibbleworth fire. You said that the shells hit the area this box was in that had fallen off there at the time. What happened then? What, just to finish that story.
Yes. The shells, the correction had been made in the air and they landed right on the box where we would have been. It blew the box to smithereens, of course, and all the contents were splattered around the thing. And my co-driver, who was keen on his food, called on the intercom. Hold on, sir. I'll nip out and get that. It won't take a minute. Can't waste all that good grub. I said, you stay where you are. And we kept going back. And it was never worth a correction. I'd been made me land in this. And Paige, of course, then came on and said, thank you. Never wasted work, Paige, didn't. But we then stayed there, just milling around a little bit, watching, because there was another habit the Germans had of having snipers in trees. That was a popular pastime, particularly if they could spot an officer with a beat service cap on. Now, I always used the word very, but we did have a couple of chaps killed by snipers. They were hiding in trees and they used it to their advantage. And we stayed in that position for the rest of the day. I gather that the troop on my right, 3 troops, spotted the Nibbleworth and knocked it out.
Would a Nibbleworth shell actually damage a tank much if it hit it?
No, it would give you a nasty shock. It would be a jar. You get the blast coming inside. The feeling of the power of the explosion would get you in the back because there was air between the turret ring, you see. That's where it used to affect you. But it wouldn't do much damage to the tank.
But it would be something you'd avoid if you could...
Oh, yes, definitely.
You know, so you wouldn't invite it.
No. What could happen, if it should land on the entry hatch of the driver on the periscope, it would blow it onto the driver and he could break his legs. One did happen occasionally. The driver was killed. He was bending forward and the shell landed on the escape hatch. And it knocked the periscope into his head. Yes, that can happen. And it wouldn't obviously damage the tank very much, but it can, on occasions, cause a certain amount of trouble.
Now, so you'd stay, not much else happened?
Nothing happened there.
Would you withdraw at night to a lager back across the Bailey?
Yes.
Or would you?
Not over the Bailey, no. We went back to near where my sergeant was trapped in the river. In the stream, he stayed there overnight.
Your corporal, you mean? Corporal. So that yes, back down the stream then.
Back down the stream where he went over and tried to get over.
Now, what was an overnight lager? What would happen to you? If you can remember this time.
Yes. Well, on this particular occasion, and it always happened, you withdrew for the night because tanks at night were useless. You had no illuminated gun sights. So you were practically blind at night. You withdrew to a lager, and the ground that you had made during the day was occupied by infantry. They came up at night and took over that ground, and you moved back to what was considered to be an area of comparative safety, but you were there if the infantry were counterattacked to go forward to assist them. While you were in that lager, you then made up with fuel, water, food and ammunition, and that was the first thing you did before you even considered getting food for yourself or having a sleep.
Now, let's take this in. What formation would you adopt? Would it be a squadron or a troop lager? Or
a squadron.
And what formation would you adopt? Would you just be higgledy-piggledy or was it a formation?
No, you would face the enemy and you would get in position where you had a certain amount of concealment, at least I did if I got the chance. So that if anything should come.
You weren't in lines or anything like that?
Not necessarily, no. No, you were a bit higgledy-piggledy. You didn't get in lines. I always like to be independent so that all 3 tanks could fire if necessary. If you were in lines, only one fired.
Now, what about where did the food and everything come from?
Well, once you got into your harbour area, your lager, squadron would then bring them what were known as the echelon. Now these were the 1500 weights with the food on, and then the ammunition and petrol or diesel and all the rest of it. They came up And they had a hard time because we were on the north side of the Bailey that we had crossed in the morning. We could see the road on the other side of the Bailey Bridge, which was lined with traffic, soft vehicles bringing up all the rations. The Germans were shelling the road. They hit an ammunition truck. That blew up. It set fire to a petrol van behind it. And there was utter chaos. Our stuff got through, fortunately, and we took our ammunition and all the rest of it. And when that was completed, we then lay down.
Now, what each one of these, how would you get the fuel?
That came in what we called jerry cans. There were special cans. I don't know how many gallons they would hold, 4 or 5 gallons probably. And they had handles on with a clip, and you released it, and that allowed the cover of the cap to be removed to pour the petrol. There were handles on so you could lift them easily. They were quite strong. They were in general service.
And you just pour it into the tank. Where was the cap? I mean, it's a daft question. Whereabouts would you pour it?
I can tell you.
not your job.
It wasn't my job, no. And I've forgotten. I would know one time, but I've forgotten 50 odd years ago.
Now, yeah. Ammunition. Would you ask for what you'd fired?
Yes. When the engagement was over, one of the things that you did on your way back to the harbour was to inform your squadron leader how much ammunition you wanted. You would be automatically given the food that was your ration. But the ammunition, only you would know how much you'd use. So you said, so many rounds, so and so, so many the other. And that would be provided for you.
Now, what about food rations? We haven't looked at this properly. No. Now you're in action in Italy. Yes. What was the system of food rations that you got? Was it compo or what was it?
There were several kinds. If you were on the British Army headquarters, you got a certain amount of what I would call dry rations. You had the compo, you had tins of bully and that sort of thing, tins of beans. If you were under the American Army, as we were in the Fifth Army on occasion, you got 5-man packs.
Well, let's look at the British first. What was compo? I mean, people don't know now.
You had tea and milk in it, and you poured this stuff into your cup, and that was supposed to be tea. It didn't taste very good either.
Would the compo come up as boxes?
Boxes, yes.
And what would be in the box, a typical box? There were different types, I know, but...
Bully beef, tins of beans, tins of soup sometimes. That if you've got certain packs, you might get even a bit of fruit in it. But occasionally, you get sort of tins of tongue and all that sort of thing. You never knew what you were getting under British regulations. It was rather a mixture, actually. Sometimes you got flour, if you were in, supposed to be a static position, to do a bit of baking. No ovens, of course.
And what did you think of compo?
Fair. I preferred the American style pack myself.
What was wrong with the British before we look at the room?
Too fiddly, and too much of a routine. You knew more or less what you were going to get anyway.
So although it differed, because you said it was different with the British.
Yes.
Although it was different, it was from a narrow range of things.
Yeah, it was from a narrower range, yes. There wasn't the variety that was in the American packs.
Now, what would you get in the American packs?
Well, you'd get soya links. You'd get those sort of sausages. You would get tins of various Spam and things like that. You would get tins of fruit. You'd get tins of beans. And a range of soups, a wider range. And these were quite nice. You'd get biscuits on occasions, too, which again were very nice. So you had a wider range. And we all thought they were more convenient. And
in what way?
For a 5-man pack, you've got rations for 5 men.
Well, and there were 5 of you.
And there were 5 of us in the tank, you see. So that worked out very nicely. And we enjoyed those.
Now, who would do the cooking and how would they do it? I'm thinking of an active service thing, like when you're in lager.
Yeah, well, in lager, you had a little primer stove, a little petrol cooker. That was one way of doing it, but that was a very slow business. We were adept at brewing tea, and that was done on a fire. We had a big tin full of sand or earth, We poured diesel on it, put a match to it, two bars across, and you put a water tin on the top, and these two bars across the top, we rested a tin on there, which was full of water, allowed it to boil. It was rather peculiar, really, because we used to put a match into the water. We believe that that match would take away the taste of diesel. I think that was psychological rather than factual. But it didn't taste too bad, but it was wet and warm, that was the main thing. And that was our normal sort of routine of making tea, any odd moment. Food, that was normally confined to evenings in Larder, in the harbour. That was the only opportunity we had. And even that was sometimes spoiled by shelling, and we might even be called out to support an infantry group.
And you helped with the
crew? I helped with meals. Yes, I would do any job that was required. There were times when I was called away to an old group. And, of course, there were, remember that the chaps had to do sentry duty, because even though we were in harbour with infantry in front of us, you never knew that patrols would get through, and you had to have guards around the tank.
Now, who would set the guards around
the tank? Well, the guards would be set by the NCOs, Sergeant Major to begin with, and he would be assisted by the sergeants in the troops, and normally you set your own guards for your own troop. But there may be occasions when, if we were in an extended order, we might have to have one or two on the perimeter in case of patrols infiltrating. And they, again, would be drawn from the troops.
Now, you didn't have wireless guards, I understand. No. You know, a wireless monitoring system.
No. No doubt that the squadron headquarters would have a listening guard on, but we didn't. Any calls to contact a troop leader would be done through runners. And there would be runners available at squadron headquarters who knew where the troop leaders were should they be required.
Now, what about these O groups? What exactly was an O group and how did it work?
Well, an O group is an order group in which orders are given to the particular either troop or squadron officers. It depended on what had to be done. I think of one occasion, which we'll come to later, where I was the only one involved in the order group. It was an action in which my troop and my troop only were taking part. Other groups, you'd have the squadron troop officers all together, and a plan of action would be formed in an attack in which each troop leader had got a job to do, and you were told in that order group what you were doing and what the others were doing, so that you knew exactly what was required of the squadron as a whole in the attack.
Would you be briefed as to the situation overall?
You would be briefed as far as they knew as to what was in front of you. If they knew from either a recce or an aerial reconnaissance of what there was in front, you would be informed. But in 9 cases out of 10, there was no idea of what was in front. 9 cases out of 10.
And then when you'd been briefed, would you mark up maps? How did the maps work? Did they have
You had a plywood board, you put your map on it, and you had a piece of cellophane over the top, plastic, fastened with elastic bands, thick elastic bands, clear of the area that you were operating in. You had China graph pencils, and they were fastened to a little flap on the map. You marked the map with code names. Now, suppose you were doing an advance along the road and on the field at the side. If there was a road crossing, that would be given a code name. As you advanced, when you got to that road, you would report Peter 1, port out. In other words, port was the code word. And that day they would have wines or whiskies and things like that. Other times they would have towns. Other times they would have racetracks. There were all sorts of things, but you would be informed at your own group what the code for the day would be. You marked up your maps accordingly. I've got my maps upstairs, actually, with the code words on. And you'd have public schools. That was another one. And when you arrived at that particular road that was marked, you reported it back to squadron headquarters. They should then report it back to regimental headquarters
And Peter 1 was number one troop, was Peter, and 1 was you.
Yes.
2 was your sergeant, 3 was your corporal.
Yes. And they all knew all the code words, because when I got my orders from the old group, I went back and told my troop corporal and sergeant exactly what we got to do, and I gave them the code words of the various crossing points. So that if I should be knocked out, they could report.
Did they all do that? Was that good practice? I mean,
well, that was good practice. Whether they all did, I think they're supposed to, but I know I did it. I must confess, you tended to live in your own little compartment. I mean, I knew exactly what I was doing with my troop. What the others did with theirs, I don't know. They went back to them, but whether they told them as I did, I don't know. You weren't interested because you got your own little bit of action to do.
Now, when you got your orders, was there... I'm not suggesting a sort of democratic thing at all, because obviously there wasn't, but if you were given an order and you knew something that perhaps the colonel or the major didn't know, were you allowed to sort of mention it? Or were you just there to take orders and do it whatever?
Well, you were supposed to be there to take orders, but we were a territorial unit, and I'm afraid once or twice I said to the squadron leader, you know, we've been in the lead the last 2 days, we were ordered to be in the lead for the third day. You felt sometimes that you were getting a little bit too much of the forward troop business. Occasionally they would say, well, you know, I'm afraid you're the only one with a troop officer left, the others have been killed, and there was a sergeant.
What about if you thought the orders were just wrong, not just the order what if you just thought the orders weren't feasible, or that there was something they'd forgotten about?
I wouldn't have been afraid to point it out. I did in one instance in the book, you'll see, that I didn't be rude about it, but I saw the situation from the right at the sharp end, and the colonel in charge was about half a mile back and didn't know the situation. And you read it in the book, of the bottleneck. Have you read that bit? We'll get to it.
Okay, so anything else about O groups?
No, you were given your orders and that was it. You were very often in our situation, the squadron leader would say any questions. If you got any questions at all, you were allowed to put your point of view forward. I mean, it was democratic in that sense. You still got your orders, but at least you put your point of view forward. And I did it on occasion, I'm afraid. Not, you know, brutally or anything like that. But,
now, you had to do all this before you got to bed. Before you got to sleep.
Lay down by your tank, yes.
Now, I wanted to ask about sleeping arrangements, because there's a variety of things. Did you carry these bivouac things that they did over the back of the tent?
Oh, yeah, you had a tarpaulin, that was all. But very often, if you never put those down unless it was wet or cold or windy or something, normally you just rolled in a blanket.
But you didn't have this thing that made a sort of tent on the side of the back of the tent?
No.
Did you ever dig slit trenches to sleep in?
No. And you never slept under your tent, never.
Could you just explain why?
Yes. If it should heavily rain or the ground was soft, your tank would settle down into it and you would be squashed underneath it. Even when we were bombed one night, we didn't get under the tank. We slept in the tank.
So you just laid on the floor under the tarpaulin? Wrapped up in your blanket?
Very often, just in a blanket. But in fact, I had mine stitched up down the side, so I slipped into it.
Could you sleep in those circumstances?
Yes, so like a top. Exhaustion. That's what it was, exhaustion. Yeah, you'd be worn out. The tension, for one thing. You remember, you were moving forward into battle, and there were loads of danger that there was an 88 waiting for you. So the tension was like anything else.
No, I think we'll move on. I mean, we were looking at a lot of general points there about lagers, but if we look on to the next day then, I mean, you know, I'm not sure how far we can go day by day, but certainly in this attack on Casino, what do you remember of happening the next day?
Well, the next day was one of being shot at, mainly, without shooting at anything in return. We were ordered onto a hill feature of my troop, and we were just to observe. and see if there's an enemy around. And we got up there, and when I got there, I realised it was a bit of a wooded valley on the left-hand side. But I couldn't see anything without going and sitting right on the top of the crest. Well, things like that I never did, because you were just a sitting target. It was like being on a rifle range. And I always liked to have the tank protected. So I stopped, held down, and I jumped down and went on foot through the long grass to look down into the valley to see what there was. And I had a good scan round with my binoculars, of course. I had to scan round, but there wasn't anything to see. There were a few shells flying over, none really close to us. One or two bits of shrapnel around. And on that next day, I spent about 10 minutes, I suppose, looking round, but there was no sign of anything. And I went back, and when I was just getting up to climb in the tank, I noticed my revolver had gone. And I dashed back, and there it was on the ground. And the lanyard had been cut clean through, so there must have been a piece of shrapnel that had gone between my arm and the revolver. Put it back in the holster and went back. And just at that moment, as I climbed into the tank, I heard a whacking red shell coming over. And the shriek of this thing, it was a massive thing, and it dropped about 6 to 8 feet away. The tank rocked like a cradle. Never known anything like it. You got used to shells landing around it. And it just rocked, and there was a great crater at the side of it. There were lumps chipped out of the tracks. And the patch that held the doors of my hatch open had been severed through, practically, one of the catches. It was a massive thing. And there was little score marks on the side of the tank. And I felt the blast of that. I was just blown straight down into the tank. But that wasn't matter. Whether they'd seen me or not, I don't know, but it was a jolly good shot. Just the way they didn't hit us.
Now, the next period, it seems to be just in the book, it's sort of clearing areas and consolidating. Do you remember anything more about that period than you put in your book? Seems to have gone on for, I mean, that was the 14th day of being shelled, I think.
Yeah.
And then the next thing you really remember is round about the 27th of May. Anything else that's not in the book you remember of that period of control?
No, because it was a peculiar period. We were simply consolidating the ground that we'd made, and we'd go forward, no opposition at all in the way of infantry. You get shelled, that was regular comes, that was. And you'd go along roads to make sure they were clear, that the Germans had not left an ambush there. Because what they would have liked you to do is go straight on the main road and then come out behind you, you see. And with bazookas, you had it. They get behind. So we cleared side roads, checked that farms were unoccupied and things like that. That there were no tigers or tankers lurking around. They would get you anyway if they were there. But that was the main object of the exercise. As we push forward slowly, consolidating the ground, making sure that there was nothing left behind. There's one incident in there where we got to a farm where we were supporting infantry, and we'd been ordered up to this particular position. And the farmer arrived in the middle of operations and looked round, and there were dead Germans there because the infantry had attacked, and some of them were taken prisoners as well, there were live Germans as well. And the farmer turned up, and I was amazed to see him, because that normally didn't happen. He looked round, and he went to speak to the infantry officer, and the infantry officer saw what appeared to be a reserve platoon, and this chap took away about 8 or 9 of the platoon, and they started digging. What on earth's going on? And they brought wine jars out of the ground. He hid them from the Germans. He came over to me because I think he thought I'd been left out of it, and Viva l'Inglese and all the rest of it. There was no shortage of the volunteers to help him drink the wine, of course, as you can well imagine. And I said to the sergeant, I said, just pop along and have a look and see what's on the other side of the farm, will you? So he went over, and I was waiting to see if there's anything on the radio to come in the way of further instructions. Because we were there with the infantry, and he nipped over and came back to the infantry. Have got it well covered in front. They'll call us if they need anything. If we go forward, we'll be in contestable position. He said, there's nothing left in the farm. The Germans have cleaned it out completely. It's a shambles. And we stayed there, I think, most of that day off and on, just checking around. We just moved around.
Let me check. So that Monte Cassino had fallen by this time, hadn't
it? Yes, it had.
That you weren't directly involved in that?
No.
You could see it, out
we could see it, yes, because the tanks couldn't get up there, you see. It was quite useless, the mountain. It was infantry work only. And I think that was the day that we moved out that morning, and we could see the flags flying, Polish flag and the English flag, flying side by side, and it was obvious that the monastery had fallen.
Now, you seem to have moved into the Monte Grand and Monte Piccolo area there.
That was our main centre line. You see, it was a defence in depth from the German point of view. The idea at Cassino was that we would go past Cassino along the Leary Valley. Hopefully, that the Germans would evacuate that once the monastery had fallen, but they didn't. The paratroopers were defending it, and we had quite a tussle to get through. But when we went to Piccolo and Grandi, that was the next occasion, and there, there was a sort of open area between these two peaks, Monte Grandi and Monte Piccolo, and the road went between them. That was our centre line. Now, we couldn't go through there until the peaks were clear, and that we knew that the Germans were on the right peak in strength, and they occupied it by dawn. It was empty by night, but by dawn it was occupied, and they stayed for the day there. We moved into the area of flat ground approaching these peaks, and we lined up, in this instance, in line ahead, in troops. And we were told that the tall men, they were the guards, were coming to join us after a forced march, because they were going to attack the people the following morning, before dawn, to get there before the Germans did. The guards arrived about midnight, after a forced march, tired, no food, worn out. They got to attack before dawn. So each tank set to and prepared food for the Welshmen. They were the Welsh guards. And we provided food for all of them. We opened our spare rations and whatnot, and gave them some allowance. And they had a meal before they settled down to rest for an hour or so. Then they had to be up, faces blackened and ready to go up this peak to get there before the Germans. Sadly, the colonel of the guard, I think it was the colonel, decided not to ask for an artillery barrage because it might alert the Germans. It, to our way of thinking, it was a mistake, because when the guards got up there, the Germans were alerted for them, and it was chaos. We, at the same time, they went before dawn, the guards did. We went just after them, and we went along the road and onto the ground at the side, so that when the guards took this, we could then go through the city.
Well, between the two mountains.
Between the two hills, that's why the two mountains, yes. I was on the right of the road, three troops were sitting on the road, and four troops, I think, were behind us. But I was on the right of the road, and the mountain side went up fairly steeply. And as I said before, I'd like to get in a position where I was out of immediate sight with a certain amount of cover. And I got into some trees in this open area, and I just sat and waited. And I heard this noise of the firing, and I knew then that the thing had misfired, because I could tell it was Spaniards firing and Germans. And this went on for quite a long time. And we were sitting there waiting. Suddenly, I saw two figures way in the distance coming down the hillside. And I got the gunner onto it. I said, two figures coming down the right. I told him where to look for.